The Guardian.
Hello, John Dennis here with Guardian Weekly, news and views from The Guardian's team of reporters and commentators. This week, panic on the world's markets as the global credit crunch claims its biggest scalp yet.
What the Fed has done over the past week has been enormous in its magnitude. It's thrown billions of dollars at the market. It's effectively nationalised Bear Stearns.
Violence explodes on the streets of Tibet as China denounces what it says is a plot to destroy its Olympics.
We've seen several marches, in some cases thousands of people, for example in Xiahe, where I went.
And Uganda's president defies the International Criminal Court by refusing to hand over rebel leaders for trial.
These were the first indictments handed down by the ICC, and I think the ICC will be very keen to see them upheld, and it will be looking for Western countries to put pressure on Uganda and Museveni.
The collapse at the weekend of America's fifth biggest investment bank, Bear Stearns, produced panic in the world's markets. Share prices slumped, the dollar and the pound fell, and the price of oil soared. The financier George Soros said the current financial crisis is the worst since the Great Depression. Alan Greenspan, former chairman of the US Federal Reserve, said it's the most wrenching since the Second World War. Larry Elliott is our economics editor, and he's here now. Larry, what are the historical precedents for the current crisis?
Well, I think Soros and Greenspan are right. I don't think we've seen anything like the turmoil that we've had over the last 9 months in the financial markets for 70 or 80 years. Certainly nothing in the post-war experience comes anywhere close to it, either in its magnitude or breadth.
How does it compare with Japan in the 1990s?
That's probably the closest parallel, in that you had there a very severe boom-bust cycle in the Japanese real estate market and in the stock market, which then burst, and authorities were quite slow in dealing with it. And Japan got into what's known as a debt deflation spiral. Price of land kept going down, prices went down, and when the government tried to revive the economy with cuts in interest rates, it didn't work because inflation was falling and you could never actually get interest rates low enough to get people spending again. And that's really what the Federal Reserve is trying to avoid, although I think this crisis potentially is worse than the Japanese crisis, because at least that was actually contained to one country, albeit a very big country. The rest of the world in the 1990s had quite a good decade. Growth was very strong, particularly in the US and in other emerging markets. So this one has got a real global reach, and that's what makes it so potentially dangerous, I think.
The US Federal Reserve has made it easier for banks to lend to each other. You mentioned lowering interest rates there. What more can central banks do to calm the markets and restore confidence?
I think there are two things. Obviously, what the Fed has done over the past week has been enormous in its magnitude. It's thrown billions of dollars at the market. It's effectively nationalised Bear Stearns. And I think if this doesn't work, there are two things that have to happen next. The first is the US government has to realise that the absolute root of this problem is what's happening in the US housing market. House prices there are still falling. Foreclosures are going up, so it's not only affecting those properties that are being foreclosed, but everybody else's property in the neighbourhood. So I think at some point the government may well have to bite the bullet and actually stop foreclosures. It might have to perhaps nationalise that part of the housing stock, take it off the market and prevent it being sold, because only that, I think, will stop house prices going down. The second thing that has to happen is coordinated international action to defend the dollar. I think the fall in the dollar is one of the scariest parts of what's been happening over the last couple of weeks. The US at some point is going to have to get together with the other major countries, with the ECB, Japan and with Britain, to orchestrate some sort of dollar rescue. The fall in the dollar drives down the level of stock markets. It makes people very wary about holding US assets. And it's actually been driving up the price of oil and gold, because they're actually priced on the global markets in dollars. So as dollar goes down, oil prices go up. If the central banks could get the dollar underpinned, it could well bring down the level of oil prices, which would actually give a boost to the global economy.
Well, George Bush has been trying to reassure the markets earlier this week. Let's hear what he said.
One thing is for certain, we're in challenging times. But another thing is for certain, that we've taken strong and decisive action. The Federal Reserve has moved quickly to bring order to the financial markets. Secretary Paulson has been is supportive of that action, as am I. And I want to thank you, Mr. Secretary, for working over the weekend. You've shown the country and the world that the United States is on top of the situation. Secondly, you reaffirmed the fact that our financial institutions are strong and that our capital markets are functioning efficiently and effectively.
This year, of course, Americans vote for a new president. What are the possible political repercussions from the credit crunch?
Well, you'd have to say that it's not a great time to be a member of the Republican Party in theory. This is the worst possible time to hold an election in that the economy is obviously going to be very weak this year. I think the US is already in recession and will probably remain in recession for at least the first three quarters of this year, which takes us virtually up to polling day. I think there are quite a lot of bitter Americans who are very upset about what's been happening in the financial markets and how essentially they've been driven to the point of penury by the stupid actions of both people in the real estate market and by people on Wall Street who bundled up loans and got lots of toxic waste into the financial system. And I think if the Democrats could choose a candidate who could perhaps come up with a solution to re-regulating the markets and actually solving the economic crisis, they would do as well in 2008 as Bill Clinton did in 1992, which was the last time the economy actually overshadowed an election year.
Larry, many thanks. 西藏有关部门正在。The protests in Tibet's regional capital Lhasa began peacefully on March the 10th. They marked the anniversary of a failed 1959 uprising against Chinese rule. But they exploded on Friday into violent clashes. China says 16 people have been killed. The Tibetan government in exile says the death toll is far higher. Tanya Branigan's The Guardian's Beijing correspondent. Tanya, China has banned foreign media from Tibet and sealed it off to the outside world. So what do we know about what's happening there?
Well, the problem is, as you say, that it's very, very difficult to find out what's happening inside Lhasa. Journalists have actually been thrown out now. There were some Hong Kong journalists who were working in there and were removed yesterday. It's also the case that it's much harder to get hold of people inside the capital than it was previously. I'm finding that people I'd spoken to before are now sort of having numbers unobtainable and so forth. A lot of people are simply too frightened to talk, understandably. What we are hearing from several sources is it sounds as if arrests began in the capital even before the deadline to protesters to hand themselves in ran out, and that paramilitary police have been doing house-to-house searches and taking away Tibetans. The exact numbers vary. We just don't know how many people are involved here.
And there's also been unrest in some other areas of China.
That's right, and that's one of the really interesting things about this. The protests spread even when Lhasa was quite quickly put under a lockdown by the Chinese authorities. There started being protests elsewhere. I have to say, not by the sound of it, the kind of anti-Chinese violence and riots that obviously took place in Lhasa, according to the witnesses I've spoken to. These have been more restrained, although there have been attacks on government buildings, but there hasn't been the kind of personal ethnic violence that Lhasa seems to have experienced. But yes, it's really interesting that it's spread so quickly. It's happening in provinces in the rest of China outside the Tibetan Autonomous Region, which is what most people know as Tibet, in places with large Tibetan populations. We've seen several marches, in some cases thousands of people, for example in Xiahe, where I went, which is in Gansu province, probably around 3,000 people sort of marched in protest against the government. And that has to really be alarming to the authorities. Even in Beijing, actually, we saw yesterday candlelit vigils by students protesting at the government policies. And although those have been very small scale and peaceful, even those are actually so sensitive that we weren't allowed access to them to film them.
The Olympics in Beijing later this year, of course, this couldn't have come at a worse time for Beijing, could it?
No, and the government obviously is worried about its international image, particularly in this year. I mean, the Olympics were supposed to sort of shine this wonderful light on China and show the world the very real achievements that it has actually made in the last sort of few decades. And instead, it seems to be now showing the world perhaps all the things that the authorities didn't really want aired in public. I've been to the once-a-year press conference with the Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao, perhaps rather badly timed from his point of view, and he was actually really ramping up the rhetoric. The government's been very much more forthright. It's launched a bit of a publicity drive in the last day or so, and they're now accusing the Dalai clique led by the Dalai Lama of not just deliberately inciting the riots in Lhasa, but also doing so in order to sabotage the Olympic Games, all in the course of splitting off Tibet. Now, of course, the Dalai Lama both denies inciting violence and denies wanting Tibet to be separate. He just says that they want more rights. But there's obviously a bit of a publicity battle going on there. And as I said, very different accounts.
The Dalai Lama has said that he'll step down if the violence spirals out of control. Is that a possibility, do you think?
Well, I don't think it's very likely that the violence is going to spiral out of control for the simple reason that the authorities now seem to have established pretty good control, certainly over central Lhasa, which was under lockdown with very, very large presence. But also we've had accounts from several people of thousands of paramilitary police in regions such as Gansu and Sichuan and Qinghai. And there's really a sense that the police are moving in large numbers, that journalists and other people who might be independent witnesses to events being kept out of the regions or actually removed. And so it sounds as if the government's established control pretty effectively. Now, we may still see small-scale protests, and it looks as if those are still breaking out in one or two places, but it's obviously at a much lower level than it was before.
Tibetans have a history of non-violent protest, but that doesn't seem to have been the case this time.
No, it is very striking, as I said, from numerous witnesses, and many of those are non-Chinese, that they told us that there was really quite horrendous ethnic violence going on, attacks on not just Han Chinese, actually, but also the Hui Muslim population in Lhasa. What's interesting, actually, is that the Chinese state television has been stressing the fact some Tibetans were actually helping the Chinese and were horrified by the attacks on the Chinese. And we've heard accounts from other people too of Tibetans in Lhasa hiding Chinese people who are being hunted. There's obviously been real violence. We've heard of people being beaten, stoned. Even one witness who spoke to me believed he saw a man stabbed. And it's very striking. I think what that really reflects is this real growing sense among the Tibetan population, not just that their cultural expression has been repressed or their freedom of speech and so forth, but also a sense that they're being really completely marginalised in their own land, that perhaps they're missing out on the opportunities that the Han Chinese who've moved into the area have enjoyed. Now, the Chinese perspective on this is, in fact, there's a very widespread sense here, not just from the government, but among the population, that Tibet is an integral part of China, but also that it's a very undeveloped part of China, and that the Chinese are really doing Tibet a major favour by pumping in billions and billions of yuan, by sending people there, by building infrastructure like the railway that goes there, and really helping a very economically backward country to develop. The Tibetans say, well, actually, we're not getting the benefit of these economic policies. It's all going to the Chinese, and essentially they're moving in and taking over our country, and we now feel marginalised.
Tanya, many thanks. I'm John Dennis. Still to come on Guardian Weekly, why the wealthiest countries are failing to act to improve sanitation in the world's poorest nations, even though they could improve the health of billions of people.
This was the great Cinderella of the development movement. This is the one issue which no government really wants to get behind.
And Neko or Tachi?
For lesbians in Tokyo, the all-important question can only be satisfactorily answered in one of two ways. Neko, a bit like femme, or Tachi, a bit like butch.
A letter from Japan from a reader of the print edition of Guardian Weekly. But first, Natalie Bennett, the editor of that very publication, is with us. And Natalie, you're going to tell us about some of the things that are in this week's print edition of Guardian Weekly. And we've got Chris McGreal later in the podcast this week talking about Uganda. But Chris has written an interesting piece about modern-day racism in South Africa.
Indeed, this is an analytical piece that starts from a video that's come out, a rather horrific video that shows some white students at a university very much mistreating black workers there. But Chris looks much broader than that, the question of, is South Africa really coming to terms with racial difference, with racial equality? And the answer sadly seems to be no.
And award-winning novelist James Meek and Guardian writer has written about the future of the Russian speciality borscht.
Indeed, you might think that beetroot soup is just beetroot soup, really. But you'll find with James Meek, as he says, this was the ultimate Soviet dish. And he actually follows the dish around various parts, finding along the way that it wasn't really actually originally Russian at all, but Ukrainian. And the big question is whether or not you put pork fat in it. But what he finds ultimately is very much the whole taste of the dish has changed. And it may be that the future of it lies not in some mama's kitchen, but in a whole lot of chain stores.
And the National Portrait Gallery here in London is celebrating strong women.
Yes, the title of the exhibition is Brilliant Women, and this is in the 18th century. Paris had its wonderful salons. Also here in London, there were a great many women. Mary Wollstonecraft is the name that everyone will know, Catherine Macaulay, the historian, and lots of other women who together were very much leading intellectual life in Britain. But as we have from one of the Thomas Rowlandson cartoons we display, they took some tough times along the way from public opinion, but now they are here back on display and in very fine fettle indeed.
Natalie, many thanks for that. And don't forget you can find out more about those stories and how to subscribe to Guardian Weekly at guardianweekly.co.uk. And to mark World Water Day, Guardian Weekly publishes a special supplement this week about the problems of water shortages and sanitation around the world. John Vidal, the Guardian's environment editor, returned to Dhaka in Bangladesh, where he reported on the problems of poor sanitation back in 2003.
I went round the urban slums in Dhaka, which are something almost unbelievable. People have absolutely no facilities, whatever. Maybe one toilet 150 yards away for 3,000 people in each of these slums. I mean, it's absolutely hopeless. No running water, no sanitation, whatever. And I was sitting with a group of 10 women, and I kind of casually said, how many of you have lost a child to diarrhea or other sanitary hygiene diseases? And I thought I'd get one or two. In fact, almost every single one of them put their hand up. And this was when it hit me right from the start that this was the great Cinderella of the development movement. This is the one issue which no government really wants to get behind. It's a taboo subject. Sanitation is not on the agenda. It's only just got onto the UN Development Millennium Goals on the back of water. But this is the one area which development groups, governments do not want to look at.
Now, you've just been back to Bangladesh. How had things changed since 2004?
Well, Bangladesh is actually one of the countries which is doing the most at the moment. I mean, it really has got hold of the issues, grabbed the issue, and it's not waiting for governments and aid. It's really trying to do it itself. Every village we went to, there were huge numbers of toilets and whatever waiting to be put in. I mean, they really are beginning to understand that this is the key to their development. Without good hygiene, you will have no development ever. And this, they made it very clear that you in Britain, you know, when we had the great stink 200 years ago, when London was such a mess, when we invested a lot of money, following that you had the Industrial Revolution. And it absolutely depends completely on hygiene.
The World Health Organization says that as many as 5,000 children die every day because of poor sanitation. And these are diseases that are entirely preventable.
This is the insane thing. This is the simplest things to understand, is if you don't wash your hands after you've been to the loo and you handle the food, you're going to get diarrhea. Kids just die very, very quickly of diarrhea, especially in very hot countries. It's so simple to understand. But people don't want to do anything about it.
The UN has set a target of halving the proportion of people without access to adequate sanitation by 2015. Is it on course to meeting that Millennium Goal?
No, I think there's absolutely no chance whatever. The water, it's linked with the water target. And governments are putting in a lot of money towards water now to provide, you know, access to safe water. But the sanitation bit is just left at the end. I mean, to give some idea of the scale of the problem, Dhaka, one of the great cities of the world, maybe 12 million people, has at the moment 12 toilets, 12 toilet blocks for 12 million people. And it's a crisis. There's a health crisis taking place right now, and nobody wants to look at it.
John, many thanks. The Ugandan president, Yoweri Museveni, has said he won't hand over to The Hague the leaders of his country's rebel Lord's Resistance Army, indicted for war crimes. He says that instead, Joseph Kony, the LRA leader, and his commanders will face Ugandan courts. It's part of a peace deal to end a 21-year civil war. Chris McGreal's our Africa editor, and he's on the line now. Chris, this was a particularly gruesome conflict. What are the LRA leaders accused of doing?
They face a number of charges, everything from abducting children as fighters, abducting women as sex slaves, to mutilating civilians, cutting their arms and legs off, their lips sometimes, to mass murder of civilians, essentially a reign of terror against the civilian population of northern Uganda.
Mr. Museveni says his people, including the victims of the conflict, would rather the LRA leaders were tried in Ugandan courts. What does Uganda's so-called traditional justice consist of?
Mostly it's built around apology and recompense rather than, as Museveni would put it, retribution. You go to the people that have been affected, you offer a deep apology, explain why you did what you did, and you offer them some form of compensation for their loss. That's the traditional on-the-ground thing. Although in the case of Joseph Kony, the LRA leader, the government's also saying that there will be some kind of trial at Uganda High Court.
Under international law, Uganda must send these men for trial at The Hague. Is there anything the International Criminal Court can do about this?
Not much, unless, of course, they leave Uganda. Then they can demand that another government arrests them. They can put indirect political pressure on the Ugandan government, particularly countries such as Britain, which were instrumental in setting up the International Criminal Court. This, after all, was its first case. These were the first indictments handed down by the ICC. And I think that the ICC will be very keen to see them upheld, and it will be looking for Western countries to put pressure on Uganda and Museveni. It's not clear that they will, but that's the only route open to the ICC.
How damaging is this to the credibility of the ICC?
Well, there are those who say that it's very damaging, as I say, because it's their first indictment. And I think that what is worrying for the court is that through the 90s, with the international ad hoc tribunals for places like Rwanda, Sierra Leone, Liberia, was a sense that international justice was being brought to bear. There would no longer be impunity for African leaders. This is a step back in terms of international law in the eyes of many people, because it says essentially peace agreements can override the need of justice, and that will only encourage people in the future that commit crimes to simply seek amnesty as part of a political deal.
There is some support for Uganda's stance from other African governments.
Yes, there is, which again I think are somewhat concerned about the rising pressures from outside on questions of international justice. I would think that Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe, this is an issue that concerns him right now. But also the idea of sovereignty. Sovereignty, it has been somewhat eroded in Africa. If we go back to the 1970s and people like Idi Amin, despite his appalling crimes, other African governments defended him to the extent that they said Uganda was a sovereign territory and nobody had a right to interfere. The establishment of these international tribunals has eroded that, and I think some African leaders would certainly like the idea that they are not accountable outside of their borders.
Also this week, Chris, there's been controversy at another international tribunal concerning war crimes in Sierra Leone. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, that involves two members of a pro-government militia that fought in Sierra Leone's civil war. That militia committed terrible crimes against civilians as well as the rebels. They mutilated people, murdered people, rape was another charge, crimes against humanity. But in sentencing these two men, the court said mitigating circumstance was that they were fighting on behalf of the government to restore the legitimate elected government against a rebel organization that was particularly unpleasant and brutal. And so they sentenced these men to 6 and 8 years in prison. On appeal, the prosecutor, backed by groups such as Human Rights Watch, have been saying no, that justice should be blind to intent. The sentence should be the same, and they want to see greatly increased sentences for these two men.
Chris, many thanks. Now, each week, one of our readers or listeners provides a snapshot from their part of the globe. And this week, a letter from Tokyo, from Helen Veach.
Is it brunettes you go for? Do a few extra centimetres leave you weak at the knees? Is it a nice arse that does it for you? Or maybe you just like to meet someone with a good sense of humour? For lesbians in Tokyo, The all-important question, sometimes fed into via all manner of throwaway pleasantries, can only be satisfactorily answered in one of two ways. Neko, a bit like femme, or tachi, a bit like butch. The hasty sociologist in you might conclude, this is simply a case of lesbians imitating heteronormative gender roles. You know, in any couple, there's always one who is more masculine than the other. Then why the question? If it were really that simple, would the woman not just be the one wearing lipstick instead of trousers? So let's just say that, like a lot of things, it all comes down to sex. That is, which role you play. Think top or bottom. You see, appearances can be deceptive. Further available identities include skatachi, a tachi who wears a skirt, and zubon neko, a neko who wears trousers. When you have roles like this, everyone knows where they stand and what they have to do. But sometimes you've just got to break away. So, fast becoming the role of choice for today's discerning lesbian is that of liba. Liba comes from reversible. You're flexible, you can do it both ways. That includes one or both of you doing it both ways, as well as adapting your role to that of your partner. Well, as progressive as liba may initially sound, all it does is reinforce the duality of the neko-tachi system, without acknowledging anything outside of either or. Even if, in reality, the distinction between the supposedly distinct roles is so blurred that it would take a powerful pair of heterosexism-tinted glasses to make it out at all. Theory aside, it simply does not satisfy the diversity of needs and desires in question. So, there are plenty of women who do not see themselves or their relationships in these terms. However, the tendency among women-loving women to feel the need to make sense of relationships, desires, and ultimately oneself, in such binary terms, surely bears witness to the powerful role gender plays in everyday life in Japan. On a lighter note, a woman goes up to a zubon neko in a bar and says, "What's your type?" How does she reply?
Helen Veitch's Letter from Tokyo. Guardian Weekly's producer is Matt Haywood. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.